Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. This is a very fun episode that I wasn't expecting to do, but really enjoyed the interview. So while staying at my friend's house in Los Angeles and researching the episodes for the Source Cult, I happened to meet their landlord. And he was so cool and so nice that I ended up talking to him for at least 30 minutes just on our chance meeting. I tell him I love this house. It's just so cool. There's got to be so much cool history here because it very much looks like a, I think it was built in 1963, and it very much has that vibe where I'm like, there's got to have been a lot of cool parties here. Like something cool went down here. So we're chatting for like 30 minutes. Greg eventually comes home and joins in on the conversation, and we just had such a blast and he had such interesting stories that I asked him, could I please interview you for my podcast before I head back to Colorado? I just feel like you have stories for days. And so we went to his house. A couple days later, we meet his beautiful wife, and we discuss his very colorful, very interesting life. And one of the things that prompted me to be like, hey, let's sit down and chat, is when he was outside of our friend's house that, you know, they're renting from him, he starts saying, okay, Rob Reiner and Penny Marshall lived next door. Ted Danson lived across the street. Tom Hanks, when he was filming Bosom Buddies, lived over there. And I was like, that's so crazy because I'm researching the Source Cult right now. And a young Rob Reiner dated a young Isis Aquarian, which I talked about in the Source Cult episodes. I encourage you to go back and listen to those. So yeah, I just thought that that was crazy. I'm literally researching something, and I had to hear Rob Reiner in the Source Cult, you know, story mentioned, and then he tells me Rob lived next door when he was growing up there. But what I didn't expect as well in our interview was the crazy Manson cult connection. So this is just going to be a very interesting portrait of the times of the 60s and the 70s in Los Angeles. So let me set the scene. He agrees to the interview, and he invites Greg and I over. So we pull up to this beautiful 70s kind of style house in the valley, filled with cool art, antiques, a stained glass window designed by his late nephew. There's a gigantic tree well over 50 years old in his backyard, an outdoor bar, and a great conversation with a great man happens. An interesting man, a family man, and a man that's lived a thousand lives, at least in terms of being the Forrest Gump of his own real life story, a kid who was present during so many historical moments of the time. This is Bob. Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. And I have a guest today who is not a sinner at all, just a man with very interesting stories and who I met by sheer happenstance while staying at Kristen Luke's house, and had to give him a rent check because he owns the house they're renting, and I'm house squatting right now with them, and I had a lovely conversation with him, and we couldn't stop talking, and I was like, dude, you got interesting stories. I got to interview for a podcast. Like, there's no way you're getting away from this.
I'm ready.
Yeah. So this is Bob, how do I say it? Marmor. My bad.
That's okay.
Bob Marmor.
Call me anything as long as you give me money. I'm good.
Why do I want to make a Jew joke there? Jesus Christ. Come on. You led me into that. That was unfair. That's my personality as well. But I come from an Italian family, and my nanny, who's Italian, says that she feels that Italians and Jews have very similar personalities.
The Jews and the Italians in New York.
Yeah.
We're the same.
Yeah.
I mean, the same. You can, the food, the parents, the family.
Yep.
I have very close friends who are Italian, who we are of the same, nature.
And she'll take money out of your cold, dead hands. I mean,
and food?
She doesn't eat that much, oddly enough, for an Italian. But she's very, she's gotten more generous in her older age, but very money focused and very money driven. But she grew up, whatever, in the Chiarinelli Palace in Rome. Anyways, So, Bob, tell me about yourself. Like, what did you do for a living? I assume you're retired now.
No, I'm not retired.
Still working?
I'll be tired. I'll be tired all over again. Retired. I have three daughters.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have three daughters and retire. Even though they're grown, they're three daughters, and I'm the dad. So I love working. I don't mind working. I'm a financial advisor, and I help people retire, mm-hmm. except I'm not going to retire. And it's interesting because people recently, over the weekend, was talking to a client, and he said, you know, I never talk about it, but I know it was your birthday, and are you thinking about retiring? And I said, no. And I give them the standard, you know, I have three daughters. I'm not going to ever retire. But I said, no, I love what I do. I'm helping people make money. I enjoy it. I'm not digging ditches. It's very easy to get on the phone and talk and help people. So, no, I'm not retired.
Well, and I'm just remembering, you came to pick up the rent check on your birthday. Wasn't it on your birthday?
No, my birthday was Thursday, and I picked the check up on Saturday, but it's the birthday weekend.
Yeah, yeah. But you should just be able to relax, but you're still working.
It's not difficult, you know. I relax in the afternoons.
Okay. Oh, good. All right.
The market opens here at 6:30 in the morning. In New York, it's 9:30.
Mm-hmm.
And closes here at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. In New York, it's 4 p.m. So my afternoon is completely free here in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And people back in New York, they're, you know, getting on the subway or going home. And I'm sitting out in my backyard smoking a cigar.
All right. Well, it's a good life. So what brought you to L.A.? So you were a New Yorker.
So I was born in New York, and my brother and sister were 16 and 17 years older than I was when I was born. And
whoa.
Yeah. My parents wanted a... My mother was 40 when I was born.
Okay.
And basically they had two lives for my brother and sister, and then came along, you know, then I came along in 1956.
Then you were the cherished, spoiled little boy, I bet.
Always.
Yeah.
I grew up as grew up as an only child with an older brother and sister.
So, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, they made their mistakes with a brother and sister, you know. And when I was born, I had no restrictions, did what I wanted to do, and you know.
Oh, so they didn't like overly protect you.
Oh, my God, no. I was given freedom. You know, I grew up in this area called Queens, New York,
mm-hmm.
Flushing. And Flushing Meadow Park, not far from Flushing Meadow Park where the World's Fair was, which I went to the World's Fair several times. And we used to ride our bikes as kids. You know, we would get on our bikes and ride for hours after school. And parents didn't worry. If they did worry, we didn't know it. And I was like 5-8 miles away from my house riding around the fairgrounds after the fair closed. And now the park is Flushing Meadow Park. And that's also coincidentally where the U.S. Open takes place. It used to be in Forest Hills, and they moved it to the World's Fairgrounds. And coincidentally, the U.S. Open is on now as we're doing this interview.
I think you told me your parents or your dad owned a some sort of garment factory.
My father, my grandfather, and my uncle manufactured sweaters. Basically women's sweaters, and they were, you know, the term generic. Nobody knew the term generic back then, but they would put different labels on for whoever the company was. And they basically wholesaled the sweaters out to the companies.
I see. Whoa. So could it be that they're making like a generic sweater. Could someone that was, let's say, Diane von Furstenberg put her label on it, but someone that wanted to sell it for cheaper would put their label on it, and no one knew the...
I mean, theoretically, yeah. But there were names like Bobby Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
They would manufacture. I don't remember all the names, but I remember Bobby Brooks was one of their customers, and they would have the Bobby Brooks label in the sweater.
Okay.
And I'm sure they could have sold the sweaters to a retail store with their own name on it as well.
Interesting. So what made them move out to... Well, tell me more about New York, because this is where Billy Joel comes in.
Well, so my brother-in-law and sister My sister has since passed, but my sister,
sorry,
thank you, was in the music. They were in the music industry. My brother-in-law created a company back in the early 60s, mid 60s, maybe like 65. And it was bubblegum music. And so that was the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, Lemon Pipers, Ohio Express, the Shangri-Las, the Loving Spoonful?
The Loving Spoonful. You told me that. So tell me the Shangri-Las song. That was
Leader of the Pack. They were on motorcycles, and it was Gone, Leader of the Pack. Mm-hmm. Now he's gone. And surprisingly,
we should drop that actually in. Like the, what was the Loving Spoonful's famous song? I can look it up. I know it. It's like, it was played in Forrest Gump or something.
Yeah, right? There were so many. John Sebastian was the Loving Spoonful's.
Okay. We'll drop one in. It's okay. Anyways, so he had all those bands underneath his label, Bubblegum.
Bubblegum. It was called, the first name of the company was Kama Sutra Records. Mm. And then they changed it to Buddha Kama Sutra.
Because it was a little too seductive.
It was the 60s.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it was the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, it was before Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And then Woodstock came along, and then they had Melanie, who, I've got a brand new pair of roller skates. You got a brand new key. She recently passed away.
Is that about key parties? What does that mean?
I don't know what it was about. She just, you know... Melanie was a vegetarian,
uh-huh.
To the best of my knowledge, and she did very, you know, her music was based upon being healthy and being, you know, I think that was more of a love story. I've got a brand new bicycle,
yeah.
brand new pair of roller skates, you got a brand new key, because back then, roller skates were like these little metal things that you put on your shoe,
mm-hmm.
and you would have this key to tighten it,
okay,
and so you couldn't put the roller skates on if you didn't have the key to put it over your tennis shoe.
So she was just trying to go see the guy.
Yeah. She had the roller skates. He had the key. Let's go.
Okay. It was much more innocent than a lot
I think,
of things.
I think it was an innocent thing.
Okay.
You know,
Melanie was
love
a good kid.
Love child. It was love children. That was, you know, back in the day. That was it.
So they start, your sister and your brother-in-law start this company.
The record company, yeah. Buddha Kama Sutra Records, and they were pretty successful. My brother-in-law was the first, it was Merv Griffin, and Merv Griffin used to have theme shows. And my brother-in-law, back in the mid-60s, had a, he was invited to be on the Merv Griffin show because the theme was people who are under 30 and made their first million. Now, $1 million in the 60s was an enormous amount of money. Not that it's not a, you know, it's a good number right now, but $1 million, it's like, oh my God, that's a lot of money.
Since you're a financial advisor, can you tell me what it would be today off the top of your head?
Oh, I would guess $1 million today has got to be $10, $15, $20 million today. Back then,
I was going to try to guess an exact number and see how far off I was.
Well, here's an example.
I'm going to go with 17.
The house that they bought in the Hollywood Hills, mm-hmm. in the mid, like 1966. Off of Outpost Drive in Mulholland,
mm-hmm.
Right above the Magic Castle at the top. They paid, in 1966, they paid $100,000 for this house. 1 acre of land, flat. You can see the ocean. You can see Hollywood. You can see downtown. They paid $100,000. When my brother-in-law sold that house years ago, it was like $5 million.
It's insane. That's why real estate's a great thing to invest in.
Real estate's always great.
Yeah. That's crazy. So what brought them out to, and then the rest of your family, what brought everyone out to California?
So they moved out to California. My brother-in-law and sister moved out to California to raise their two kids. And here we are. We're in New York. My brother had also moved out here to L.A. And so my mom and dad are saying, okay, our grandkids are in L.A. Mm-hmm. We're in New York. It's cold. We got humidity in the summer. And we want to be near the grandkids, and I get it, because now that I have grandkids, I'm thrilled that we're all on the same coast. My middle daughter just recently with her husband moved back from New Jersey. They lived in New York and New Jersey. She was there for 11 years and met her husband, and they came back here. And they moved out here, and then now we have a three-month-old grandson with him. He's my third grandchild. So I understand being close to the kids, that, you know, to be able to be in their lives every day and know who we are. So we moved out. We moved out in 71, so we could be closer to the kids, the grandkids, my nephew and niece. And my father sold his company. He sold it to my uncle and to my grandfather, and packed up, and we moved out here on July 1st of 1971.
Great memory. I don't even remember when I moved anywhere. I thought Billy Joel was a bit of a draw for moving here.
Billy Joel is interesting because Billy Joel was recording in New York when we were still living there. And my brother-in-law, Artie, used to go back and forth with my sister.
He managed him.
He was his first producer. He discovered him. He along with another close friend of the family, Irwin Mazur. Irwin was Billy's manager. And they basically brought Billy to the table.
Your brother-in-law discovered Billy Joel.
Along with Irwin, yeah.
That's crazy. And oddly enough, you look a little bit like Billy Joel.
I don't sing like him, unfortunately.
Well, who among us does?
My... No.
Yeah, there's a piano here.
I wish I did. I took piano lessons when I was a kid, and I was really disappointed in my piano teacher because every time I hit the wrong note, he would take a pencil and poke me in the side. And I finally said to my mom, I said,
we can't,
I mean, that's child abuse today, you know. So I lost a career in piano playing and entertainment because of Mr. Luke's.
You know what? It could be like, but you could have started a band and you could have named it something like Leonard Skinner because they named their band based on the fact that they had a music teacher that told them they'd never make it or something like that. Or just a gym teacher. Whatever. Just like told them they sucked as people. And they were like, okay.
And here I am. This is what I do. Yeah. I sucked and you poked me in the side with a pencil.
Yeah, you could have done that.
I could have done that. Maybe I will.
Can you play a few notes of Piano Man? I'm not saying to do it right
now.
But
no.
You can't even play any. Okay, that's fine.
I can't. I mean... I can sit at the keyboard at the piano when I was younger and be able to just like kind of play things just by ear, or try to figure it out. But it's not entertainment by any means.
And I didn't mean to say you can't play anything. I meant to say like, oh, you can't play. Like, I was like hoping that you could play like just a little bit of Piano Man.
No. My daughters probably could because they had piano lessons.
And
they weren't poked in the side.
I can do nothing in music. So, okay. So. Your brother-in-law discovers Billy Joel. How did he discover him?
So
where was he at?
Well, Billy was playing in some type of club out on the island in New York. Irwin's father managed the club. It was a bar, nightclub, performing, and Irwin and my brother-in-law Artie then got together and said, Artie, you know, check out Billy, and Billy was hired. So they started recording his first album, and it was recorded in New York. I was still living in New York at the time, and it was Cold Spring Harbor. That was the name of the first album. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the album of Cold Spring Harbor, you will see the logo of Family Productions, which I'll later show you a picture of it. And a lot of the albums back in the, you know, it became Family Productions. After Artie, so my brother-in-law sold his company, Buddha Kama Sutra, to his partners. And then one was Neil Bogart. I can't remember the other guy's name. But he started his own company called Family Productions. Mm-hmm. And so he came out west and started Family Productions out here and invited my father to join as the controller of the company, controller of the money, and not in the entertainment section at all. And We came out here. His first album, like I said, Cold Spring Harbor, was recorded in New York, and then also here in L.A. There, and when I was living in New York, we had an opportunity to go to the studio when my brother-in-law was recording one of the songs from Cold Spring Harbor, and I was sitting in the studio.
And how old were you at the time?
I was probably 14, 15, probably 14 or 15, because we moved out. We moved here. I was 15 and a half. And so I was, it was maybe that year, 14 or 15.
How cool.
And I, it was called Falling to the Rain, which to me, I love his first album. It's a lot different than, I love all of his music, but the first album was totally different than everybody, every other album. And Falling to the Rain, I identify with because I was in the studio for however many hours they're recording that song over and over again. So, so we moved here in 71, and when we moved here, my father became, like I said, he became the controller for the company, and he was in charge of doing, you know, financial aspects of the company. One was when Billy and his first wife Elizabeth moved out here, they needed a place to stay, and so they first rented a place, like I think I mentioned to you, on Laurel Canyon and the 101 freeway. It used to be called Howard's Weekly, an apartment, type of an apartment that was there, and it was right on Laurel Canyon, and that's where Billy lived, you know, when he first came out here, you know, right 101 Laurel Canyon, just by Riverside Drive, just a little bit south. That was his first location that he lived here. Then they rented a house for Billy. My father found a house for him right below the Hollywood sign near Griffith Park over there. And he was living there for a while.
But he hadn't made it yet.
No. He was just, they were still, this was his first album. He was, yeah. They were trying to, you know, get airplay on the radio stations with his first album. Billy was, nobody knew who Billy was at this point.
Yeah. I was like, well, if he hadn't made it yet, how was he affording a house?
Oh, no, he wasn't paying for anything. My brother-in-law was flitting the bill for everything. He hired Billy. He managed Billy. He was the producer. And the way that industry worked is, you know, the company, the record company, pays for everything, and then at some point the artist, you know, pays them back, hopefully.
That's when the industry was good. You get taken care of. You don't have to work seven jobs before.
No, it was totally different. Yeah. Totally different.
I managed 30 Airbnbs until I made it in comedy and podcasting and, you know, any entertainment. I managed the apartment building I lived in. I worked pretty much all night long, essentially, but I would then go do stand-up. No one was foot in the bill for me. That was when it was different.
Yeah. Different world.
Yeah. But it all worked out.
It worked out for Billy, I would say.
Yeah.
I think he's okay.
For all of us.
I think, yeah, for all of us. But, yeah. You know, if you're going back to Billy.
Yeah, he's certainly okay.
I think he did okay.
So your brother fronts Billy Joel's, you know. Were you living here when he recorded Piano Man on, or came up with the idea of Piano Man on Wilshire Boulevard? And the
Piano Man was, my brother-in-law was no longer representing Billy for Piano Man. They had some disagreements, and Billy left and made a deal with my brother-in-law to let him out of his contract, and so he went to another record label. Mm-hmm. When I was here, it was kind of interesting that Billy was performing. They were, again, this was like the beginning of his career, and they're trying to get him to play in local venues to get him out there. The album was out, Piano, Cold Spring Harbor was out, and, you know, getting airplay, and now get the artist to perform in local venues. So there was a venue out in the West Valley on Ventura Boulevard that Billy was performing at, and he performed in his Converse. That was his, back in the day, as I remember, that was what he liked to play in, his Converse, his black Converse. And he got to the venue, and he didn't have his Converse. Oh no, how is he going to play? Along came, as I'm known in the family, as Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Bobby, can you go over to Billy's house and pick up his tennis shoes? Sneakers. I mean, back then they were called sneakers. Nobody called them tennis shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you get his sneakers? And yeah, I got the keys and I drove up to Hollywood Hills, got his sneakers, and drove it all the way back out to the West Valley. And, you know, Billy was able to perform because of me.
And again, you're just a kid experiencing all this.
Yeah, but I had been around entertainment and rock and roll area all of my life. Like I said, my sister was 16 years older than me. So, you know, when they were in their 20s, this is what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And here I'm a kid. So I grew up with all of the, you know, all of the entertainment people. I mean, names that I can't even think of. Doris Troy, she had a song called Just One Look. Mm-hmm. Artie did that. I mean, there was a lot of music. So here's kind of
so cool.
Here's kind it's of cool. a story that, you know, we had mentioned about Tommy Smothers. Now Tommy and Dickie Smothers had a variety show.
Smothers Brothers.
The Smothers Brothers. And it was one of the hottest variety shows, kind of like an Ed Sullivan show, and, you know, whenever they were on Sunday nights or whatever it was. And they were just a comedy act. I mean, they played off each other. It was really, you know, a great show. I mean, as a kid, I remember that. And this was even before we moved to L.A. So this was probably in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. We moved here in 71. So it had to be like, maybe I was 13. Actually, I was 13 years old because this was before my bar mitzvah. It was 1969. And I'll tell you why I remember that. 1969, I came here. My sister brought me back to L.A., for the summer, to spend the summer here in L.A. with her. And it was the summer of Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And they were in the middle.
Summer of the Manson murders.
Summer of the Manson murders. It was a good, you know, the moon landing, 69. Mm-hmm. So I was here for that. And prior to that, let me digress for a second. Prior to that summer, my brother-in-law and sister used to fly to New York a lot, back and forth, and they used to take the red eye from L.A., mm-hmm. get to New York, land in New York, JFK at, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, and come over, see her parents, see my sister Phyllis's parents and us, and then Artie would go into the city, do his, you know, his, go to the studio, do his business. As a kid, I remember being picked up from school in a limo. Because they would take a limo. It was a big deal to be in a limo back then.
Yeah.
Big stretch limo.
And you were picked up from school in a limo?
Yeah.
Well, the chicks must have loved
it. I was actually taken to school in a limo because here, 6 o'clock in the morning, they're coming from LA, landing, getting picked up in a limo. And yeah, I wouldn't mind a ride to school in a limo. And so I went to this, you know, this school, and here I am with my friends. They're all like, oh my God, can we come? Of course you can come. And so we get the door, you know, the limo driver comes out, opens the door, and here come these kids, you know, coming out. And so it was pretty fun. It was pretty fun back then. You know, limos were a big deal. Nobody had limos. Nobody saw a limo. In Queens and Kew Garden Hills, nobody saw limos, you know. You know,
that's
you saw on TV the big limos. So
God, I hope you have a photo of that.
I wish I did. It's up here.
Yeah,
it's up here. If I could project it, yeah. I would show you.
It's hilarious.
So 1 year, and this was before I was 13, because this was the summer. So probably somewhere when I was 12, I would say. Artie, my brother-in-law Artie, was doing some type of a record deal with Tommy Smothers, and maybe Dickie, I don't know, but I just remember the record label was, and I used to get all the albums for free, you know, I was on the mailing list, I got every single album, that whether they made it or didn't make it, I had like a huge, huge vinyl collection, and it was called Smobro, SMO-BRO, Smobro label. And Artie was producing a song for Tommy. They came by in the morning, dropped my sister off, and then they were going to go into the city. Artie and Tommy were going to go into the city and go into the studio, whatever they were doing. But they said they would come back at night and hang out with us. But don't tell anybody that Tommy Smothers is coming, you know, is going to be in your house. Well, okay, this is a small town in Queens, Kew Garden Hills. Tommy Smothers, who is a big deal at that point in time, isn't going to be in our house. Don't tell anybody? Okay, come on.
Yeah, you know? And you're also 13?
Yeah, 12. You know?
Yeah.
I'm telling a couple of friends.
And I love that you say he's going to come hang out with us. Like you're the 12-year-old's like hanging out with the adults.
Yeah, Tommy Smothers is going to be in my house.
Were you bringing a case of beer at 12?
Well, I'll get into that story because that leads into a great story. So Tommy comes to our house. They come back at night. They come to our house, and I don't know, half the neighborhood is in our house. I don't know how it happened. I told this one told that one, and all of a sudden he's got, it was fine. My father was, you know, Tommy liked his scotch. And he also raced motorcycles and with his brother. And so by the end of the evening, and I had never tasted scotch. I'd never tasted alcohol. I was 12 years old.
Because you're 12.
I'm 12. You know.
You're not Drew Barrymore yet.
No, no. So we're sitting. Everybody's talking to him and asking questions, and he's being very gracious. And he's a celebrity, you know. And he's not just hanging out with the Marmers. You know, he's hanging out with the Marmers and their friends. So my father kept on pouring. And when he was finally done pouring, you know, the evening was over. And so Tommy, you know, they were going to go back to the hotel. And Tommy ends up going outside. And I had my Stingray bicycle, you know, with the banana seat back then. Well, you don't know because but
I know what a banana seat is.
The banana seat and the Stingray with the big handlebars. And it was like parked right in front of my house because I had to be... That was my parking spot.
Mm-hmm.
That was my parking spot. Don't touch my bike. Mm-hmm. That's my parking spot. And Tommy sees the bike and he says, "Hey, Bobby, you mind if I take a ride on the bike?" "Do I mind? You're Tommy Smothers. You want to sit on my bike and take a ride for it?" "Of course. Do what you want. Maybe I'll end up selling the bike for, you know, $100 when you leave, you know?"
I'm loving this story so much.
So Tommy gets on the bike and he starts pedaling. It's a kid's bike, 12 years old. He starts pedaling. He's a pretty tall guy, probably over 6 feet. But he races motorcycles. The guy knows, you know, how to handle himself. And he starts riding. He tries to pop a wheelie, and he falls flat on his ass. Flat on his ass. And everybody's watching. And it's like, but he's drunk.
Yeah.
They finished a bottle of scotch.
What do you expect him to do?
Yeah. I mean, come on. He's a big Hollywood guy, you know?
But also very down to earth to just be like hanging with the neighborhood.
Hanging with the guys in the hood.
This reminds me so much of Almost Famous. I wanted to say this earlier. Your whole life reminds me of that movie, Almost Famous, like where the kids in all these scenarios. And, you know, it's like when the lead singer of the band or whatever is hanging out. He just wants to go. He's in Topeka, Kansas. Just wants to go hang with real Topeka people and goes to like this high school party. And the young kids like watching him do like crazy stuff. Like, yeah, just.
I was very close to being Almost Famous. You know, I was because I grew up with the entertainment group. I mean, more of the rock and roll and the music industry. I mean, a lot of people that I used to see. Fast forward to 1969. So that you have the premise of meeting Tommy in my house in Queens now and him getting drunk off his ass. Fast forward to 1969. I'm out in L.A. with my sister and brother-in-law living in their house in the Hollywood Hills for the summer, going swimming and, you know, doing all kinds of stuff.
Picking up chicks.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A black book like you couldn't believe. Yeah. This kid from New York with his New York accent. So my sister's birthday was August 10th, and they were in the middle of remodeling their house, and they were friends. They were still doing, you know, they were still friends with Tommy Smothers, and my brother-in-law wanted to make a party for her, so they wanted to use Tommy's house for the party.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't going to be there, but the party was right off of... Sunset and Doheny, right in the hills above Sunset. Sunset Doheny Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he was renting the house. I don't think it was his, but regardless, doesn't matter. We had the party up in Tony's house, in Tommy's house, and he wasn't there. But we had the birthday party, and my sister was thrilled. It was a surprise, and blah blah blah. And we're spending the whole day there. And then at the end of the day, we leave. Now, at that point in time, my brother-in-law had a driver who was Tony. And Tony took us all back, and we got back to the house, my brother-in-law and sister's house, and she realized she left a couple of bags there, the bathing suits and, you know, all the stuff, towels and whatever. So Tony and Bobby go back to Tommy's house to pick everything up. I said, "Okay, I'll go with you. I'll take a ride back to see Tommy." And we got back to Tommy's house. This time Tommy was there. And I have this vague recollection of they were sitting around in his living room a round table. Everybody was sitting kind of on the floor. They had hard-boiled eggs and toast. And it was Tommy, his girlfriend, and a few other people. I couldn't even tell you who they were.
Were they on a diet? That
no, I think they were just terrible. they were just kind of hanging out in the afternoon, eating something, hard-boiled eggs and toast.
Okay.
I don't know if they were on a diet, but whatever they were doing. And you know, Tommy was very gracious, and he said, "Oh, hey, Bobby, hey, nice to see you. Yeah, we got the stuff. We got your sister's stuff here." He said, "Can I get you something to drink? And can I get you, you know, Coke, you know, water?" Scotch and soda? Scotch on the rocks? Now, again, I had not ever had alcohol. Maybe I had a little sip of wine, you know, traditional wine for the holidays, for the Jewish holidays, the Manischewitz wine. Certainly that's not alcohol. And so I said, oh, yeah. I said, laughed. Yeah, I'll have a scotch on the rocks. Tommy gave me a frickin' scotch on the rocks.
Tommy's not a dad at this point. He doesn't know. He just wants you to be happy.
Well, I later...
Or maybe he was. I don't know.
Well, I think he kind of remembered that my dad got him shit-faced and he fell off my bike after the whole bottle of scotch. That's what I bring that back to. So he gave me this scotch on the rocks. Now, I had never had scotch before, never had alcohol before. Somehow or other, I'm drinking this worse than cough medicine at the time to me, you know, eating some bread, and somehow or other, I finished it. I don't know how I finished it. Maybe it was a one-finger scotch. It wasn't like a lot, but it was a lot. I mean, for a 12-year-old kid.
Well, that's a gross-sounding drink for your first drink. Yeah. I don't even think I could drink that now.
Yeah. Well, I like scotch now, but it took me a long time to overcome that. But
yeah.
So I managed to finish this scotch. And, oh, you finished, Bobby. Let me get you another one. And by this point... Tony saw where it was going, and he said, you know, I think we should get going. So we got going. We went back to the house. The world was spinning for me. I mean, I was just spinning like the teacups ride at Disneyland. That was my head.
That's hilarious. We took a quick break so I could verify that I was correct on this, because I did a whole Manson series and deep dope. And what's also interesting about, which I'm sure you know, the, you know, part of the motivation behind the Manson family murders, or a lot of it, Charles Manson was slighted by, he lived with one of the Beach Boys, Dennis Wilson, and Terry Melcher, their producer, which I don't know if your brother knew him or you ever heard of him, claimed he was going to maybe sign Charles Manson. Then he was slighted and not signed, and so he got mad, ordered his people to go, because I believe it was Terry Melcher that lived in the house that Sharon Tate formerly lived in. Whatever. He just basically was pissed off and said, kill who's ever in that house, which is terrible and sad. That was August 9th, 1969. Then August 10th, 1969.
Was my sister's birthday.
Which is your sister's birthday. They go to the La Bianca house. The La Bianca, that was not motivated by a producer, you know, music producer living in a house. That was just, they had gone to a party next door to this house at one point, and they just randomly chose it. It's just very weird to me that night you were at different...
I was in the hill. I was in the hills.
In the hills.
Wow. Like I never knew that.
Yeah, that just, it's very, very eerie. And your brother-in-law... was in the music business, and like, it's just very, very eerie.
That is a weird coincidence.
Because another part of it is the first person killed in the Tate, in that murder, was a young kid like yourself. He was like 18, I mean, older than you, who was going to visit a friend who lived on the property of that house. He was like a house, he took care of something, whatever. And just randomly, the friend who was just a little bit older than you was leaving the house, and he was the first person killed by them, just as like an innocent bystander. I mean, everyone was innocent bystanders, but like, that's so weird. That is one of the eeriest parts of LA history. And you were a kid sauntering around on scotch that night.
Yeah, I was a visitor. I wasn't even living here.
Yeah, but
I happened to be here.
It's crazy. You could have been an innocent bystander, because they did choose a random house.
It could have been that house.
Yeah, that's just it's an interesting piece of history.
That's definitely something for me to think about now.
Yeah. Is your brother-in-law still alive?
Yeah.
I wonder if you got to ask him for me, and then you send me a text. Did he know any of the, like, people in the music industry that were ever, like, did he know the Beach Boys? Did he know?
Oh, I'm sure he knew everybody. He was pretty well known in the industry, and he was a name.
Yeah. What was his name again? Artie?
Artie Rip. R-I-P-P.
Okay. Artie Rip. I'm gonna find a connection and...
Yeah, if you Google Artie, you'll see everything.
Okay. Anyways.
Maybe more than you want to know, but you'll see everything.
Hey, I love it. Everyone's lived.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Yeah, sorry to take it on that track. Okay, I have a question for you, because the last thing I was covering on the podcast was a famous cult during that time. Did you ever hear, because you guys have also mentioned, you've mentioned vegetarian several times, so maybe you ever went to this restaurant. Do you ever know about the Source Family cult?
I remember going to a restaurant on Sunset Boulevard at the, where Sunset kind of veers off, kind of like a split, a fork.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going there with my sister years, I mean, it's not there anymore, but years ago. I believe it was the Source.
That one was called the Source. They had one called the Awake Inn.
Aware.
Oh, sorry. No, Aware. Aware Inn. Oh, something was called something
Aware
Inn.
Inn. Yeah.
Yeah, Aware Inn. Yeah, but yeah, the one you went to the Source. It's the one that's
with the seats right on the boulevard. You can sit outside and burger.
Were people wearing white robes at the time, or did they change into their more colorful outfits?
I don't remember that at all.
Do you remember the owner?
No.
Gray beard, long gray hair?
No. We had been there, I think, prior to the 1969 visit. We had been here 1967.
Mm-hmm.
When my sister and brother-in-law moved out to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were staying. They had us... Well, this was kind of cool. They put us up at the Century Plaza Hotel. Now, Century City was not there. There was nothing there but the Century Plaza Hotel. And it still has the same shape as it did back then.
Mm-hmm.
But here we were out for, like, the holidays, the Christmas holidays, to come out and see... My nephew, who was just like, you know, he was born in October of 67, so he was a few months old, so we came out to visit. And I remember looking out of my balcony at what used to be the Schubert Theater across the street from the Century Plaza Hotel. There was a parking lot, and they were filming a commercial. And I was fascinated. I mean, I don't see this in New York, you know. L.A., you know, kids saw this all the time. But the helicopter kept taking off and landing. They were filming some type of commercial. But again, Century City, I look at Century City now, and, I mean, it's so populated. Here it was vacant land.
It's CAA, the Century City Mall.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So
that's really cool. Really cool.
So that was 67 that we came out here first.
That's very cool. Do you have any other interesting Hollywood stories before we wrap up?
Next door to my house in Valley Village, when we first moved out here, the first neighbors that we had were Rob Reiner and Penny Marshall. And Rob was his first year of doing All in the Family. Penny was still working, doing commercials, and she also worked. She was on The Odd Couple, which was her brother's show, too.
Oh, I didn't know
Her brother, Gary Marshall, did that show, The Odd Couple.
I didn't know
and
she they was were brother and sister.
Oh, yeah, Gary Marshall, yeah. And that's how Penny kind of, I can't say that's how she got her start, but her brother brought her into the business. He was already a producer, and she got her gig doing the secretary on The Odd Couple for Jack Klugman. and Rob, and then they lived there. They had Penny had a daughter, Tracy, who moved in with Penny and Rob, and became Rob adopted her. It was Penny's first marriage. Mm-hmm. And Tracy became an actress as well. She was in A League of Their Own. So I'm still in touch with Tracy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I remember her so distinctly from League of Their Own. There was some sort of connection with... So I was looking into the Smothers Brothers. And then... No. It was the Source family. And I can't remember exactly what led me into them. And then I was like, oh, he had just mentioned Rob Reiner and Penny Marshall. I mean, you. And then I started like going on this like deep dive of all these like connections or whatever. And then I found out that his daughter, Tracy Reiner, was in League of Her Own. And I remember exactly her face.
Yeah.
I loved that movie. Like that's crazy. She seems like a great, great kid.
Yeah.
I love to call people kids.
They're kids. They're kids.
Yeah. That's so cool.
And Rob and Penny used to have crazy parties from what I remember. I
mean, well, it's all secluded. That's all secluded. Fenced in.
Well, it wasn't as secluded back then.
Okay.
Elijah Wood moved into that house years later, and actually he was having some stalker issues, and his father made sure that they basically built a fortress around that house. So
it looks like a fortress.
Yeah.
Yeah,
built the fortress there. Interesting that Elijah was doing a film for Rob and said, hey, by the way, I'm living in your old house. And I think Rob came and, you know, visited the house at that point.
But, cool.
But there were so many parties there. I mean, celebrities left and right. I mean, again, here I am, a kid, you know, 16 years old at this point, maybe. And because they only lived there a few years before they moved to Encino. You know, I used to see Carl Reiner come in there all the time. And, you know, all of Rob's, Albert Brooks, all of Rob's friends. We did have an incident where Louise Lasser, and she was on Mary Hartman. There was a show, Mary Hartman.
Okay.
I can't remember the name. Louise Fletcher. Louise Lasser. I'm pretty sure it was Louise Lasser.
Okay.
And she had this little tiny dog.
Uh-huh.
Tiny, tiny dog. And somehow or other, the dog got out and came to our, because we're right next door,
mm-hmm.
came to our front door. And she was, you know, we let the dog in, and she came looking around for the dog and knocked on the door and, have you seen my dog? And she was a, you know, pretty well-known celebrity at that point, you
mm-hmm.
know, but she was also like, where's my dog? You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, like anybody, like, you know, like, where's my dog? You get nervous when, you know, when the dogs get out, kind of like when the dog got out when I came over. Yeah.
And Blue went into the street, which was, oh my God.
But so she was there. Ted Danson lived across the street when he was doing Cheers. And, you know, it's interesting because in New York, when you grow up in New York, everybody lives in front of their house on the street. You
mm-hmm.
know your neighbors. I could name everybody going up and down the street, around the corner from me. I knew everybody. And my father was a very social type of a guy as well, and he used to like to talk to people, and he would always know all, and they called him the mayor. They called my father the mayor.
That's funny.
Because anybody had a question, they went to my father and asked him the answer. When we moved here, it was so weird for him because nobody knows your neighbor. I mean, you don't know your neighbors in LA for the most part. You know a few people around you, but I can't tell you who lives down the street from me. I mean, you know, you don't see people because people live in their backyards. They live in their house. They live in their backyards. My father used to walk up and down the streets of the street in Valley Village
mm-hmm.
and made friends with everybody. With neighbors. He made friends. He became friendly with Ted Danson. And Ted Danson was a pretty big deal at this point. He was doing Cheers.
I think having personality runs in your family.
You think?
You became my friend. I mean, I've forced you into my friendship.
You know, it's funny because they call me the mayor too.
Yeah.
My family calls me the mayor, and it's a good. I don't mind that.
You have a lot of charisma.
Thank you.
Okay, we're gonna end this on. I'm gonna do a few quick speed questions that I just came up with. Okay. Hopefully one wouldn't offend your wife. You guys have been married long enough, but we'll. All right. You were talking about like going to these parties or whatever. Did you ever have a young crush on like a female celebrity that you saw that was around these parties? You were a child.
When so. I was younger?
Yeah.
Not anybody that I could, you know, bring right, you know, instant recall.
Okay. So that's a good husband. Look at him. What a just... He just keeps striking all the good man
check marks.
Yep, there we go. Okay.
Well, she's not here. I can say what I want.
Yeah.
And she'll never listen to this.
Yeah. But you're... Because she doesn't care what I'm doing. Well, you're a good man. But, whatever. It would have been fine if you said something. Okay. What is your kind of fanciest... Well, you already gave your limo story. But what's your, fanciest memory of growing up in this era? Like, a place you went...
In New York or here?
Either one. It's a speed question.
Just being my fanciest thing that I would think about is just living in Hollywood, living, you know, driving through Beverly Hills. So my cousin who's a year and a half younger than me, used to come out and visit. He lives in Florida now, and we used to do the maps of the stars' homes, drive around, uh-huh. You know, Beverly Hills, and we went around and we found Lucy's house, and.
Like Lucille Ball?
Lucille Ball's okay. house, yeah. And she was still, you know, pretty, you know, a big celebrity at that point. She was still doing one of her shows. And we pulled up in front. I'm driving around. We pulled up in front. It was kind of like the corner of Roxbury and whatever the street it was. Mm-hmm. And I say to my cousin Mike, I said, knock on the door. He says, no, I'm not going to knock on the door. You go knock on the door. Jeez. And I said, okay, we'll both go knock on the door. And I don't know what possessed me to get out of the car, and I walked up. You know, it was back in the 70s. It wasn't like it is today.
Yeah.
You know, we knocked on the door of Lucy's house.
Oh, my God.
A woman came to the door dressed in a full maid's, you know, back in the day, they wore the maid's outfit, mm-hmm. you know, the proper, you know.
Yeah.
And we said, hi, is Lucy home? And she says, no, I'm sorry. She's at the studio. And we said, okay. And we left. Now, I cannot believe years later, I thought that we actually, you know, had the we call the chutzpah to you know, knock on Lucy's door.
Okay. That actually answers one of my other questions. I was going to say, what's the most dangerous thing you did as a kid? But that seems like nowadays that would be a little bit, well.
Stalker. You would be called a stalker.
Well, no, I mean, you were a kid. It's just not, you know, and that's not dangerous because it was like, they weren't going to like pull a gun on you or anything, but just like ballsy.
It was very ballsy.
So I would consider that in the risky category. Anything dangerous that ever happened in your experience here, like to you or you were around it? Because you were also around the Manson murders.
Nothing. I've led a pretty, you know, under the radar life.
Yeah. You've never even had a crush on someone, so I believe you've lived under the radar life.
No, so. I've actually started dating my wife when we were in high school.
You're so cute. This is a love story podcast. Greg, he's a good man, too.
Yes, he is.
But aspire to always be like a man like that. You got it. That's really sweet. Let's see if I got... Well, proudest moment in your life so far. Just in general in your life so far.
My daughters...
That's cute.
Jennifer, Amanda, mm-hmm. and Alexis. And then their significant others, Jennifer and Shane, Amanda and Brent, mm-hmm. and Alexis, and the dog Sammy, because she doesn't have anybody yet.
Oh,
she's not dating. She will.
She'll find someone.
And then my grandkids. Yeah. Then my grandkids. Oh. Ezra, Margot, and Damien. So those are the proudest moments. That, to me, you know, I wanted to mention one thing to you about what is life. What's good for me? You know, I was thinking about this earlier, and to me, life is all about family. You know, I grew up in a household where everybody was really tight knit. All the family was all tight knit. All the holidays, all the families from both sides. You know, the aunts and the uncles used to come over, and we would always be at my house. My mom was the one that hosted and cooked, and everybody else cooked. But to me, family is huge, and that's
I have nothing. If I have no family, I have nothing. You know?
He's going to make me cry.
I mean, the kids were over this weekend. They come over all the time. They want to be here. We have threads with my kids, like during the day. I know what's going on with my kids at all time. Mm-hmm. When Amanda was living on the East Coast, we knew what was going on. I didn't have to pick up a phone and talk to her to say she's okay. Because, you know, your kids, you worry about them. I don't care how old they are.
It's true.
My mother used to worry about me when she was in her, you know, 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, Mom, I'm an adult. I have a family with kids.
My parents are the same way. My mom, like, literally, like, when I was on another road trip with my parents after my car accident, and they go to bed at, like 7 p.m. And we're staying in, like, these cool spots I was showing them in Colorado and whatever. And they would go to bed so early, and I'm like, well, I can just stay up and work on my podcast. I'm like, Mom, I literally said I'm going to go down to the lobby of the hotel. And she was like, I don't know if you should do that. Just so nervous. She was like, and then texted me like, did you get down there safely? And I'm like, Mom, I toured the world doing stand-up. I did stand-up in Kosovo. I did, like, I went off base in Germany when we were, like, performing for the troops or whatever. And, like, we went to, like, a random strip club in this town, me and the other comedians. Like, I've been in New York by myself. Like, I can't go down to the lobby of the hotel room. I'm 39 years old.
As a parent, what you don't know doesn't bother you.
Yeah.
What you do know will drive you crazy. My daughter Alexis, who's 30, she goes out. I mean, she's an adult.
Yeah.
She's an adult. She goes out. I worry until she gets home. I can't fall asleep. My other two kids went off to college. I didn't know when they came home, what they did. I didn't know about it. I didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
If I know about it, then automatically the parent, you know, part of you says, oh, where is she? Is she okay? Did she get into an accident? Where is she? Where is she? And I can't fall asleep until she gets home. She's 30. My mother, and this is where I got it from. My mother, the sweetest lady. Everybody loved my mother. And after my father died, my mother still lived in the house in Valley Village. And so we're about 20 minutes here from that house. Mm-hmm. And I used to go to work. My office was in Beverly Hills, and I used to drive past her house virtually, you know, every day going into the city. And one morning she calls me, and she knew I got up early. One morning she calls me. It was like, I don't know, 6 o'clock in the morning. And she says, Bobby, can you come over? I said, now? She says, yeah, I need your help with something before you go to work. I said, okay, Mom. Got ready, went, got to her house, opened the door. I still see that, like, and she was hard of hearing, so the TV was like blasting loud, you know, and I hear, Mom, where are you? The lights were on. The alarm wasn't set because we have an alarm in the house at the time, and it wasn't set. It wasn't like her normal, memo. And I said, Mom, where are you? I'm in the bedroom. And I walk into the bedroom, and there's my mother in the master bedroom, and they had big electric beds. She's sitting, and she was in her 80s at this point.
What does electric bed mean?
Oh, electric bed. The raise. The foot goes up.
Okay, like a hospital bed.
They weren't a hospital bed, but, you know, the foot goes up. The head goes up. So they had pretty, you know, electric beds. And she's sitting on the floor, leaning next to her side of the bed. I said, Mom, what happened? What are you doing on the floor? She said, well, I kind of slipped off. And they were high beds. I slipped off the bed, and I couldn't get up. And I said, when was this? She says, 11 o'clock last night. I said, Mom, it's almost 7 o'clock in the morning. You slept here? Yeah, I slept here on the floor. Mom, why didn't you call me?
Oh, my God.
So why didn't you call me? I would have come over. She says, I didn't want to worry that you were going to drive here so fast and get in an accident. So I sat here. She was too worried to call me because she didn't want to have to worry about worrying.
Stop making me cry.
That's a parent. She doesn't want to have to worry.
Well,
I got that from her. I worry. I'm a worrier. But yeah, it's okay.
It's also a Jewish and an Italian thing.
It's a
parent thing. But my mom's the biggest worrier.
If you don't worry, then you don't have any basis to have a family.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. I'm going to be the worst helicopter parent. I know it. I'm going to have to hold myself back. But I'm already like that with our dog.
You get used to it. With the first one, when Jen was born, she had a little cut. Oh, we better go get stitches. Is she okay? By the time Alexis was born,
like, Dad, let her bleed
Dad,
out.
I got a cut. I just put a Band-Aid on it. You'll be fine.
It's hilarious. Well, thank you so much for doing this. This has been a great conversation. You're my new friend.
And you're my new friend too.
Come to Colorado, visit us there. You'll like it. It's funny that I can picture you telling that story about your mom, because we've been staying at Kristen and Luke's for like 5 days now. And I'm like, oh, I know that room.
I was going to say that master bedroom.
Yeah, I know it so well now.
The wall next to the guest bathroom was my mom's side of the bed.
Okay. Guest bathroom is where I've been hunkering down. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate it. And we'll see you soon.
We'll see you soon.
All right.